Greetings, creeps, and welcome to episode 27 of the Slashnings podcast. I'm your host, JR, and this is where we discuss horror's influence from the silver screen and beyond. I usually use this intro and outro to speak about either something horror-related to the episode or something just horror-centric in general. Well, I've got nothing extra to add this week. So without further ado, here's an interview. Welcome to this week's episode of the Slashnings podcast. I'm joined by Mark Roosh. How's it going, man?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Would you care to introduce yourself, please?
Sure. My name is Mark Roosh. I'm an illustrator for a long time. I've signed my name as Mr. Roosh as a joke. When I was like 21, I thought it might make art directors take me more seriously if I was like some old established dude. And it was like a dumb joke. But now that I actually am old, it's less funny. But I'm sticking with it, kind of.
And what would you say is your preferred subject matter to draw or illustrate?
Mostly spooky stuff, Halloween stuff, horror stuff. I've done all different kinds of illustration for about 25 years, editorial stuff, snowboard stuff, posters. But I feel like most comfortable when it's spooky stuff and stuff that kind of gets me scared, kind of like excited, you know?
Absolutely. And when did you first start getting into like the spooky horror Halloween sort of stuff?
Oh, ever since I was little. I also, like a lot of people my age, was obsessed with Creature Double Feature. And even if I had already seen the movies that they were advertising, I had to see that intro with the Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. Like, you know, that made such a huge impression on me. The neon, and the strobe light, and these giant monsters, just trash and everything. I loved it. And also, this is like way before we even had a VCR, there's no internet or whatever. So I would see this stuff and I would be like, I don't know what that is. Frankenstein Conquers the World. For a while, I was like, why is there a Godzilla-sized Frankenstein beating crap out of this other dude? Like I had to watch and tune in every Saturday so I could find out more and more. And I know this is a podcast, but I have visual aids. Like I got the Scholastic book, Movie Monsters.
Hell yeah.
It was so educational, all these monsters I had never, you know, seen yet or whatever. And I realized there's the Universal, there's the classic monsters. Then there's like the Toho giant kaiju monsters. Then there's the Hammer ones. And I was like, oh, they redid Dracula and Frankenstein with, you know, Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing and stuff. So as a little kid, I was like, this is sweet. This is what I am totally into.
Hell yeah, dude. I love Creature Double Feature. It's one of my absolute favorites, just getting to like rewatch replays of it. And then a couple years ago, I remember Ernie Bach Jr. tried to bring it back. He tried to be like the actual host for it. And I'm like, whoa. Creature Double Feature never had a host. It had the sick theme song and like the snippets, but get out of here, Ernie. What are you doing? But
yeah,
love that shit.
Me too.
Do you remember what the first horror movie you saw in theaters was?
I don't. When I was very little, my parents brought us to see a Disney double feature at a drive-in. And right. For some reason, I'm born in 73, and that's when The Exorcist came out. So I was a little older, but they started putting it in theaters again. So at this Disney double feature, they had a trailer for The Exorcist. And the entire place was screaming. And I was trying to see past my parents' fingers and stuff because, like, the tubular bells and hearing Reagan croaking and all the screaming. So I'm like, I want to see what that is. And so for a long time, I didn't see a horror movie in a theater. I was obsessed with this show called The Movie Loft with Dana Hersey. And they would show unedited horror movies every night in October. And so I secretly, while I was pretending to do my homework, I was crouched over this tiny TV right next to the attic. And I saw as a kid, I finally saw The Exorcist. I saw Halloween 1 and 2. I saw The Omen 1 and 2. I saw all this stuff while I was like, I wasn't supposed to be watching this stuff. So like my face is right up close to the screen. I'm trying not to breathe in case I can hear my parents come and be like, what are you doing? You're not supposed to be watching this stuff. So it was like this real intimate, you know, exposure to like big horror. I could not believe The Exorcist. I was like, this is heavy.
Very. And it's still, that's one of the few that still holds up as being remarkably and unendingly unsettling from like beginning to end. One of those few movies that still gets under your skin.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, we definitely have talked about some of the big heavier hitters and like
the word I'm looking for, horror franchises. Because, like, there's hit or miss throughout the Exorcist films, but one in three are fucking fantastic. Halloween's heads up and downs the whole way through. But there's one franchise, and with this episode coming out the day before St. Patrick's Day, it bears digging into a little bit, where I don't think there's actually been a good film in it of the Leprechaun films.
I actually haven't seen those.
Really? Okay. All right.
There's a lot of horror that I love, and there's still a lot of horror that I've never seen yet.
That's one of the awesome things about the genre, though, and I've mentioned it before on the show a time or two, is no matter how big of a fan you are, there's still a bottomless pit of things you haven't seen, and there's nobody who's ever going to be able to say, oh, yes, I've seen it all. And if you say that, you're full of shit. There's so much stuff you've never seen.
Exactly.
So I'm excited to give that Warwick Davis franchise another revisit. I know I've seen, like, the first one, the one, like, in the hood, and I think I saw the one in space. It just seemed like such a weird attempt at a franchise.
Yeah, it does.
And now, how'd you start getting into, like, so now we got the intro to horror capped up. How'd you start getting into art and illustration?
Well, ever since I was a little kid, I loved to draw, and my parents were really encouraging. My dad was a teacher. He was actually Rob Zombie's middle school teacher.
Oh, shit.
And he would bring home these outdated tests that were like mimeographs. And he would give us the blank side and we would draw and draw and draw. And I was obsessed with Creature Double Feature and comic books and all that stuff. So I would just draw constantly. And then as I got a little older, I started seeing like Frazetta books at the mall. And when I was pretty young, I bought Stephen King's Skeleton Crew and Ozzy's Bark at the Moon cassette the same day. And I was like, here we go, you know? Like, I think seeing all the metal t-shirts at the mall, the covers and the t-shirts made me want to buy the music. And so I started getting into the music and then the artwork. And I was like, I kind of want to do this for a living. I want to make scary art for album covers or bands or posters or whatever. And I just, like, dove in.
And with Frazetta in particular, it's some of the meanest, like, toughest looking art covers for shit like Molly Hatchet, which I love Molly Hatchet, don't get me wrong, but it definitely painted the wrong image for what you're about to listen to. It's like, oh, it's going to be like heavy, doomy, like Sabbath shit. And I got upbeat, fun rock and roll. I'm like, all right, but.
Yep. It's a weird thing where the customer feels ripped off.
Yep.
Like, I read about how lots of times movie producers would just pitch titles to artists and they would make these mock-up posters for movies that didn't even exist. And they would ship them to theaters. And the ones that got people's interest, the theater owners would tell the company, oh, you should make a movie with this one. And so the poster has nothing to do with the movie. You go to the thing being like, this poster looks tough. And then you see the movie and you're like, this is crap. It's like, it has nothing to do with it. So it's like this culture of kind of getting people's hopes up.
Yep. The best one I can think of, because it was the exact situation, was Chopping Mall, where I had like that shopping bag with like the heavy metal gauntlet holding it and like the guts and organs coming out of the bag. And then they're like, killer security robots. That's fine.
Yeah. As an artist, I realize there's a lot of disconnect sometimes between the art director and the art. Like sometimes the thing isn't even written yet, the story, or they don't really have a clear idea of it. So you do this thing and like, cool. And then it gets printed and you're like, this has nothing to do with like the story.
Exactly. You know? Who were some of your influences for art when you started? We mentioned Frazetta already and some of like the Bark at the Moon cover, but who were some other of your early inspirations for art?
Bernie Wrightson. I loved the Cycle of the Werewolf book. I grabbed it at like a store when I was young and I absolutely loved it. The color, the draftsmanship, and also like the balance, especially in that book. They're like these really beautiful pen and ink scenes for each month. And then you get to the main picture and it's like what the werewolf did that month. You know, it's heavy and it's like really beautiful, peaceful scene. And then like horror, it's like this they work off each other. I thought, I also really got into Pusshead, seeing those Metallica and Misfits and Zorlax skateboard things. It kind of worked out not so great for me, but seeing all that super detailed pen and ink stuff made me want to do it. And so I did for years and years and years, really super detailed stipple work with a, like a 6-0 technical pen. And my eyesight got worse and worse and worse and worse. And so far away is now like micro millimeter things from my face. I actually have to have cataract surgery in April and May because my left eye is minus 17 and I see double. Oof. And my right eye is minus 9. So the right eye is doing all the work. And so I kind of killed my vision trying to do super detailed stuff, but then the cataracts made it way, way worse. So like my fingers are crossed that, hopefully by the beginning of the summer, I'll be seeing like the world for like the first time, you know, cause it's been a long, weird, blurry ride.
Shit. That's terrifying. I obviously hope that goes well for you. And I'm curious how much of the odd different vision you've had have kind of led to what's become sort of your signature style with all the like the different posters and artwork, that maybe that's only something that could have been created by you because of the way that your eyes have been negatively affected. So now I'm curious to see, once the surgery is a success and you're able to see 20/20, like the $1 million man, you'll be able to see through buildings, how that's going to adapt and change your current style, and obviously for the better. So that's gonna be really cool to see.
Hopefully, yeah. Hopefully. But now that we'll keep going. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry, man. You go ahead. This is an interview about you.
Oh, well, I feel like a lot of detailed stuff like Virgil Finlay and like old classic horror art. That's what I really responded to. And then I felt like personally over time, I felt that there are a million people who can draw really, really well, super detailed. And after a while, I realized that I respond more to stuff that makes me feel something. And to me, it could be because of my vision, but it could just be like this change of way of thinking about things. Lots of times something is like real fleeting and you only see a glimpse of it. And that has like power because it's so brief and you don't really see the detail. You don't really see exactly crystal clear what happened, but like, for me, it's like when you see Michael Myers standing behind the hedge on that sunny afternoon in the distance, you're like, what is that? You know? And all you see is like the eye holes and like the smudgy face, or like when he's sitting outside Laurie's schoolroom with the station wagon. Like you catch a glimpse, but it's not this sharp, clear, whatever. It's like more like an impression. It's a work by artists like, there's a graphic novel artist named Stéphane Furt, who does these really textured, colorful, beautiful graphic novels. I can't read because they're all French. But I buy these graphic novels and be like, I love this. I have no idea what's happening, but this is so cool to look at. So I got less into detail and more into color and texture and hopefully stuff that will make the viewer feel something.
And that 100% comes across from your art. It is all emotionally, like, evocative. Like you get a lot from it just by looking at it and the color schemes and the layout of it. I'm glad that you're in more of that style than the overly detailed, because you're right, that was like a, not to say it was a fad, but there was a point in time where that was everything, and the artists that were great at it were phenomenal at it. Like Bernie Wrightson's a perfect example. That one from Psycho the Werewolf where she's just pulling the face off of that guy, like, dude, that stays in my head for forever.
Yeah.
Or his Frankenstein one there where he did like the illustrations for it, untouched, like amazing.
Amazing, like shafts of light coming through a window and a million books on the shelves and the monster on the table and like little dust motes floating to you. I feel like whole lifetimes that would take people to draw, and he just was producing them over and over and over. Great stuff.
Unreal. Now, my intro to your art was the posters that you've been doing for the Coolidge Theater, for their After Midnight program, for their double features out in the Rocky Woods, for the Halloween marathons that they've done. How'd you get started doing that?
It's a long, weird story. Long ago, I would go see movies at the Coolidge, and I loved it. But that was, you know, I would just go see midnight movies, and I thought that was great. Then I met a burlesque performer who had trouble she didn't have trouble doing posters, but sometimes there wasn't enough time to do a poster. And I was like, I'll do posters if you ever need a poster. Cause so many of the bands that I had done artwork for, they broke up. And I was kind of sad. Like I liked doing posters and there was nobody to do posters for anymore. And when she looked at my work, she was like, I just talked to Clinton from the Coolidge and we're talking about putting on a midnight spook show. Would you want to be part of that? And I was like, yeah. So we started brainstorming and making all these 3D props and monster costumes and masks and all kinds of stuff with glow-in-the-dark paint and literally like yardsticks and masking tape and safety pins so that, like, you know, when you see it and the smoke, you don't realize it's just this, like, flimsy thing that's, like, hung on chains. It looks like it's, you know, 20 feet tall. So her name was, her stage name was Miss Firecracker, and Clinton was the program director. And we had such a great time putting on midnight spook shows and making glow-in-the-dark merch and all this stuff. And then Clinton started hiring me to do posters for other events. And so then he left, and over time I've been lucky to have a long, fun relationship with each of the new program directors. I feel like lots of times people bring in a whole new team of their, you know, their friends or whatever to work with them when they get a new job or whatever. But Clinton and Jesse Hassinger and Mark Anastasio, they've given me so much fun work, and it's super fun to collaborate with them on stuff. I feel like we have a very similar way of thinking about stuff and appreciation for a lot of B movies and cult movies and horror movies. And it's funny. I feel like I've been on the stage or behind the stage setting up fake coffins and mummy cases and all this ridiculous stuff, trying to be like really silent because there's a movie playing and you don't want anybody to get taken out of the moment by the, you dropped a coffin on your foot or something. But I feel like I've been in all these weird areas of the Coolidge more than I've been in the sitting in the crowd lately. You know, it's been like my two Boston Terriers actually went and would see midnight movies, and they would sit there, you know, with their own little popcorn, they'd fall asleep and snore, and like, you know, on stage it's like zombie, you know, and everybody's screaming and stuff, and the two dogs are like.
So with the marathons there, what would your ideal 5-movie midnight marathon be if you had to pick 5?
Oh, that's tough.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
There's a lot of the main, you know, the doubleheader movies that are my favorites have already been shown. That's a tough one. A lot of times they've been themed, like werewolf ones or devil ones. While I think I can tell you that I was pitching to Mark, maybe not as a midnight event and maybe not as a Halloween horror marathon event, but there's so many of us who really miss Creature Double Feature. And what if they had a program of Saturday afternoons where they have Toho and Hammer and AIP pictures and stuff, and just, especially with COVID and everybody having to do everything distance, they could have online screening rooms and like kind of recreate that like Saturday afternoon magic.
That'd be awesome.
I would. Keep going.
I was going to say, it seems like there's a resurgence of that sort of like Creature Double Feature horror host nostalgia, because you have like Joe Bob, who's wildly popular every time he puts out a new thing. You have Sven Gulli, who gets more and more popular each week that it's out. So there is definitely the love and adoration for that curated spook show kind of style, and especially where we don't have any of those that really do like the Japanese kaiju movies anymore, to bring those back into the mainstream, because obviously like Godzilla and Kong are still wildly popular. That's why the movies are still coming out, they're still making new ones all the time. But then you have ones like War of the Gargantua that's fallen by the wayside. And we tell people now, like, oh no, there's one with a giant Frankenstein fighting, and they're like, no, there's not, you're lying. I'm like, no, it's real, it looks like the Jolly Green Giant. I promise you it's great. Check it out. He's got a whole loincloth and everything. Like, we need to bring those back.
I would love that. I'd love that movie.
What's the mushroom people called?
What is it?
They're like mushroom people. They're like fungus. Oh, I can't remember what that one's called. They like find them on a boat. Oh, we have the internet. We can find out.
I should ask you. You might know this. I have watched a ton of Godzilla movies, the old ones. Mm-hmm. And there's one that I can't find, and I remember it from when I was little, and there are aliens that look like regular humans, but if they die, all of a sudden you see that really they had gorilla heads and hands. And so I was like, what is happening with this? You know, it's like,
yep. Those were the bad guys from the first Mechagodzilla one, weren't they?
I knew in the Mechagodzilla ones that they were human. They were aliens who looked like humans, but I didn't think that when they died, they turned into gorilla people.
Yeah, they had like the whole monkey mask, like the face fell off of it. Those were the bad guys from Mechagodzilla.
Okay, that makes me feel better.
Yeah, you were on the right track. You were there.
Good.
And Matango was the one that I couldn't remember. They're literally just giant, like, mushroom-headed people things. It's a weird one.
I haven't seen that one.
There's your homework. We got Matango and Leprechaun. One, neither of which are good, but you'll have fun with them.
All right, good. I think if I could do a Coolidge pick the five, I think it would all be possession-themed. Because that, to me, especially reading The Exorcist at the library, and then Legion, you know, which became Exorcist 3. Reading those when I wasn't even in high school yet made like a huge, long impression. So I feel like if it was like The Exorcist and Hereditary together, those to me really are like horrifying. Not necessarily gross outs or jump scares, but you just like the horror is like an anvil fell on you.
Yep. Both very unsettling. I don't know if I could take a double feature of both of them. I would need something like real stupid in the middle. Like, give me The Exorcist, Dumb and Dumber, and then Hereditary, just so I can have like an aperitif in between the two.
Sure. Sure.
What's up? Sorry.
I was going to say, I always thought the Blob and Night of the Creeps would make a good double feature.
Oh, fuck yeah. Now, are we talking Steve McQueen Blob or 80s Blob?
80s Blob.
Yes. That's finally getting its due. Like when it came out on Blu-ray last year and had, or last year, the year before, I can't remember. It's all a blobbish blur. It finally started to get that resurgence that it deserves because the practical effects on that were nuts.
They really are. They really are.
And I feel like I still incorporate that with most of like the Body Melt movies from that era, from like Street Trash and Body Melt itself. And then the Blob definitely fits in because you had the people like falling apart inside of it, and the effects that showed you that were insane. So I don't know why that one, it's getting the due it deserves, but I don't know why it's taken so long to get there.
Good stuff.
Yes, sir. One of the other major projects I've seen of yours lately, or not lately, but in general, has been the covers for Wolfman of Mars and working with them a lot for a lot of their music and stuff. And I love and adore those albums. How did that connection come about?
Luke from Wolfman of Mars just wrote to me, and we just hit it off, and he was like, would you like to do this? And I was like, yes. Three cloaked skeleton dudes next to a hearse, and it's fall outside with leaves blowing around. And I was like, there's four dudes in the band. And he was like, well, the other one's driving. I was like, okay. It's like, they're just like dream projects and real fun. And he sends me the tracks as I start the sketching process. Same with Brass Hearse, his other project. And he's one of those people, I mean, the bands themselves are like so prolific. There's always new, awesome albums coming out. And working on those has been like dream project, total dream projects, especially the Warp Suburbian one. Like skeleton kids who are wearing old Ben Cooper masks who are spray painting like You Dink on minivans and like those crinkly plastic decorations in the windows. And I stuck a little Michael Myers with the ghost sheet and the glasses down in the corner. Like he just came out of a house. Like they're super fun projects.
Nice. I love those dudes. Love their music. Found them around October of last year when they put out the soundtrack for Satanic Panic, and it was an amazing album. Such a fun movie. Like I don't think it got the credit it deserved for being as much fun as it was.
It really was. I love that Grady wrote it too. I love listening to the podcast with him, and
well, thanks.
Oh my gosh. My best friend's Exorcism and the Southern Book Club's Guide to Slaying Vampires. Love those.
And dude, Grady is the man. That was a really fun interview to get to do and talk to him. And I've met him a time or two. He's just super duper nice. I'm excited for his new book too, the Final Girls Support Group, which is sounds like it should be exactly what the title is describing it as. It's such a cool idea. It's almost surprising that someone else hadn't thought of it, but I'm very excited to see his take on that. It should be really cool.
Definitely.
Another one of your major projects last year that came out and definitely got spread around like the horror community and did really, really well from what I could see was both your Justice Prince and your Resist Prince. And that was a really cool way of contributing, giving back to different charities and communities in the area when everything was being so hard hit. What was your, to ask what your inspiration for that would be kind of asinine. We know what caused it and we know the good work it went to. What have the results been from that?
Well, it helped get a lot of money towards groups that I believe in and support when I myself did not have the money to give to them. So people got artwork and contributed to good causes. And I don't know. For the last 10 years, I've been the caretaker of the John Greenleaf Whittier birthplace, which is like a 330-year-old farmhouse. And he was a famous abolitionist from my town. And I grew up reading horror. I didn't grow up reading poetry or anything. But I absolutely love that he was a young, really isolated kid on a farm who knew that slavery was wrong. And he was like, you know, he's like a farm kid. But he devoted his life to trying to stop slavery, even though people tried to kill him and burn him alive and stone him and all this stuff. He was like, he did what he thought was right. So I thought that was cool. And, you know, I draw pictures for a living, and it's like this nice, weird, isolated living in a farmhouse. And it's like, I see all this stuff that makes me feel crazy. Like, what is wrong with people? Maybe I could make pictures and sell them and give the money to groups that are doing good work. So, I'm glad those worked out.
I am too. They were both phenomenal pieces. They're both great. And I'm glad they went as widespread and raised as much as they did. That was a phenomenal way for you and anyone else who bought them to help contribute and help really good causes in a time where help is more than needed. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. I'm glad.
And in speaking of the Whittier birthplace, you recently put out a collection of both paintings and photographs you took from being there. And I was just flipping through that yesterday, and it's such a cool peek into that like living there and taking care of it. And some of the pieces just invoke that sense of fall and Halloween and early winter, that even though we're still kind of wintery here in New England, like it's March 14th and it started snowing today, because why not? It really did invoke that sense of fall. And there's the photo toward the end of it of the pumpkins along the gate that really just nailed that perfect New England fall feeling. I love that whole book. What's your favorite piece from it?
There's a photo towards the end of this old tree that's by itself, and it was very misty and all the leaves were down by then. It was brown and everything kind of is blurry and hazy. And that to me is like that. It's like this fun, colorful fall. And then there's like, no, like we're really in it. It's yep. Like heavy and kind of, that's my favorite photo. Painting, I don't know which one, but I think probably the fall ones. Maybe it's the door. The door with the one pumpkin in front of it. But I feel like growing up in Haverhill, I always wanted to go to Boston. And then once I was in Boston, I was like, I kind of want to go to New York. And I kind of want to do all this stuff. And then I got to a point where maybe 10 years ago, 11 years ago, I moved up here. And it's just, there's nobody. It's like, there are so many raptors and deer and foxes and possums and bobcats and it's amazing. And I wonder honestly kind of if this change of surroundings made me get more and more into folk horror. And so many of the things that I've been reading, especially this winter, like Algernon Blackwood and, you know, the Willows and the Wendigo and Arthur Machen's The Great God Pan and all the stuff where it's just kind of like, get away from the city and then things change and it's dark. It's like, you know, I feel very, very peaceful and comfortable here. I don't feel scared. You know, I'm not like, oh, I'm going to get scared in the woods. But like, I like to go out and walk in the woods when the sun's just gone down. And you hear all the stuff and you see all the stuff. And it's like you realize kind of like your scale in everything. And it's like, these woods don't care if anything happens. And that book and my life now, it's a big difference from the beginning of you know, how I lived and what I thought and everything. And now I'm just like really, really into being in the woods and just like being quiet. There's like no people and it's kind of awesome.
I agree with you. I adore and appreciate my silence and quiet. And it's crazy being in New England where we can have the ridiculous busyness and constant flow of people that is Boston, but go a little bit toward Western Mass and it's silence. It's farmland. It's quiet. It's that perfect folk horror vibe you were just talking about. And I wonder how much of that had to do with the isolation of living in an area like that, where now for better or worse, it's almost impossible to be truly isolated. We're always connected by, I'm speaking to you remotely through a laptop right now. I have my phone that a million people can know exactly where I am and what I'm doing. I've had people listen to this podcast from all over the globe. Like, is anyone ever alone? But you can simulate it by living out in the woods in Western Mass. Will we ever get to that folk horror point of true fear of isolation again? We had that kind of look back into folk horror when Midsommar came out a couple years ago, and I'm hoping that that drives more of that sort of genre, because I think that's a really good peer into human psyche versus a lot of the, and I love The Following too, but versus a lot of the jump scares and gore and stuff, is getting into what's going on in the noggin of people who are alone.
I agree. I remember over time I've become a real pause button guy, especially when something is so startling in a movie and you're like, what is that? When they go upstairs in the ritual and see what's in that room, I'm like, I'm like, this is the most beautiful, disturbing thing. I really respond to that kind of like isolation in the woods, and there's other stuff out there, and you don't really know what it is. I love the open-endedness of a lot of folk horror things, where it's not just like super clean cut and everything's wrapped up and explained. You're like, no.
Because not everything should work like that. Like, yes, that works for certain things. I feel like slashers in particular need a beginning, a middle, and an end. But the more ethereal, that folk horror vibe, The Ritual being a great example, need that kind of, that's still there, you're not safe kind of ending. Exactly. And I remember watching that like the day or two after I got back from surgery because I had broken my leg, and I was all sorts of zonked out on stuff. And I'm laying in bed playing with Legos, watching The Ritual, going, I don't know what life is anymore, but I don't like this.
Amazing.
The best way to watch it.
Amazing. I'm sorry you broke your leg.
If anything, it's kind of an amazing story, because I'm a bigger dude, like no argument. I'm a hefty Jeff. I was up on like a third floor of this, well, new at the time, Apex building in Marlboro, Mass. And I put one leg up to tie my shoe and put the other leg up to tie it, and said, haha, look, I'm fat and I'm flexible. At that exact point in time, my knee gave out. I fell, all my weight collapsed onto that leg and totally broke my left ankle.
Oh my gosh. That's terrible.
It was immediate hubris, and I 110% deserved it. And a guy came out of one of like the stores or places there, like, oh my God, are you okay? And the look was more of, fuck, he's going to sue us. And I'm like, I really can't. If you watch that video, you'll see that was 110% my fault. Jeez. So it's all good now, but it was just oddly hilarious at the time.
Wow.
Another one of your projects that you've been working on is the Wicked Spooky Comics : Home for Little Conjurers, and I got to take a peek through the full-size large issue you had put out, you said, for conventions. And obviously, first and foremost, the art is bananas and 110% captures the New England fall Halloween vibe. It's almost like if you channeled Halloween love and just New England horror through a Sam Keith lens of abstract weirdness. And I,
wow.
Love. Wow. I thought of that earlier. I'm like, I'm going to say this. I'm going to sound really cool.
Wow, that's something. I'm flattered. Thank you.
Yeah, man. The story that's in that one that features the girl on the skateboard, when was that story conceptualized?
Maybe 2017. I feel like slowly the story kind of came together. And I'm 47. And I feel like I've done a ton of illustrations for all these people, and they've been really fun. But I was like, I really want to do this thing in my head for me, just for me, and just get it out there. I feel like I don't sit down to read a book or watch a movie and criticize it as it's happening in real time. I'm not like picking things apart. I kind of go into things like open. But lots of times, no matter how much I like something, there'll be stuff that I'm like, oh, they wouldn't say that, or they wouldn't do that. Like, you know, and so you kind of get a feel for what you like and what you don't want to do. And I was like, I want to make this thing that's 100% what I would want to read. And it's tough to describe. It's a real house, one town over, and it's 340 years old, and it's just in a neighborhood right next to other houses. and you see this house, and to me, I'm like, that is so super wrong. It's doesn't have the caved in roof, doesn't have broken windows or whatever, but there are like saplings growing like 3 inches from the door. It's like, this place is so abandoned and like super haunted looking right next to these other houses. And I started thinking, what would happen if it weren't abandoned? It just looked abandoned. What if all these little kids live in the house like unsupervised, and they're not necessarily like witches, but they're like 100% down with black magic. And I really respond to horror that happens in the present day and happens in broad daylight, especially if there's witnesses. I feel like that makes it so much more terrifying when something totally wrong and impossible happens right in daytime when people are around. And I started thinking, I want to make this super horrifying graphic novel that's kind of funny too, about this house and the inhabitants and what happens when the police get involved and what happens with the people who witness this stuff and record it on their phones, and like, how super haunted does it get? Cause like, I feel like, you know, Ju-on, like the Grudge movie, it's like, if you look at that house, you're haunted. Like, it just tracks you down. You like, you know, glance up from your newspaper and like, oh, this is a house. Like, you're screwed. And I was like, so like, how far does it extend, and how are they able to stay there and not get condemned, or like, you know, the city to tear it down, or like, how do they get around all this stuff?
Awesome. Well, it's the couple of glimpses we've had into that world through both the physical release and the one that's currently up on your site. It does already kind of have that huge world built around just that neighborhood around the house. There's so much lore already kind of in it. So I'm really excited to get to explore more into that. Do we know when we can expect? You have a Patreon up running to support that project, correct?
I do. Yep. Ideally, I would like to have the first big book done by the end of this year. 20 pages in. The plot line is very long. It's like, say it's like 10 pages single spaced. And the amount of artwork and everything that I've gotten done is half of one sentence on the first page. So in my head, it's like, edit, you know, kind of, it doesn't need to be this sprawling, but like, there's a lot of stuff that I just want to see it all happen in print, you know?
Well, I'm really excited for it and really hope we get some more sneak previews out than what we already have, but I'm already signed up and I will be gladly purchasing that graphic novel once it comes out. Where can people find that Patreon online?
It's just Mr. Roosh. I spell it all out, M-I-S-T-E-R, and then my last name, R-E-U-S-C-H. Like, that's my website, that's the Patreon, that's my Etsy shop. I put all my prints and comics and original paintings and stickers and stuff in my Etsy shop. And the Patreon site, I try and update a lot. It's got backstory, it's got videos. Do you ever watch David Lynch movies?
Of course.
I feel like there are so many scenes in those David Lynch movies that I remember much more than the actual plot. Mm-hmm. I'm like, that was so messed up. The bank robbery that goes wrong, and the dog running around with pieces of somebody, and like Mr. Eddie driving the tailgater, like all these scenes that I'm just like, I feel like I've experienced a lot of strange real events in my life, and I'm like, use that in the comic. Like, there's the first five or six spreads are on my website, and that was a real thing that happened to me when I moved to a neighborhood, and I took my little puppy Frankenstein out for a walk, and this old woman shot out of a house asking me a billion questions with no downtime for me to answer any of them. And it was like, who are you? What are you doing on the street? Do you live on the street? Do you own a house? Are you renting? Who is your landlord? What is your dog's name? What is your name? I live in this house, but I used to live in that house because I lived in there very, very long time. But then my husband died in the house and I couldn't live there anymore. But fortunately, my daughter was able to swap houses with me, because she wasn't there when my husband died on the toilet, and I could never go in that bathroom again because he died on the toilet. But now she lives there, and I was just like, holy crap.
That's terrifying.
I was like, yeah, good to me. And I took off. And I was like, what if something like that happened in a comic, but it was darker? It was like an old lady talking about how she was having difficulty going up and down the chimney. You'd be like, that's wrong. That's super wrong.
And it is remarkably unsettling. And just like going on to like all fours and about biting off his ankles. I'm like, nope, I'm good. Cause that's one of those latent phobias too, is just fear of the elderly, fear of becoming that, and just going with it. I kept thinking of the 80s Twilight Zone episode of Grandma, based off the Stephen King story. Yep, yes. That's all I could think of.
That was dark.
Yeah, absolutely. It was just beyond unsettling. It's honestly the only snippet from the 80s Twilight Zone that I can even remember is that particular episode. I know I've watched more, but that's the only one I have like a memory seared into my brain.
Exactly. Me too. I thought at one point when the little kid's in the room, her head, it looked like a big melted cookie.
Mm-hmm.
Like she started out as a human. That was scary. But then her head became like a big melted cookie on the pillow. And I was like, oh, man.
Somebody relatively important directed that. Was it Tom Savini?
It might have been. It's a Stephen King short story.
Yeah.
But I feel like it might have been Tom Savini.
I feel like, I don't know why, I feel like it was. Quick Googling. Nope, Bradford May. No idea why I thought that. But Harlan Ellison wrote part of the screenplay for it, so that's kind of cool.
Yeah, that might have been what I was thinking of, because I knew some big heavy hitter was attached to that.
Yeah, well, other than Stephen King himself.
Yeah.
You know, some small-time writer from Maine, no big deal. Another really cool project of yours that we got to see live last year was you doing live music with Dr. Gasp was his Halloween stage name for it. And that's one of the coolest projects ever. And I'm so bummed I didn't get to see you guys perform at the, was it
Riverwalk Brewery?
There it is. Yep. What's your connection with him? I know that you kind of get name dropped in a song or two, but how far does that go back?
Years and years ago, probably like 30 years ago, I was taking down a friend's art show at the Middle East, and he was putting up his show at the Middle East as soon as the other show came down. And I had seen his posters everywhere. And he apparently had seen posters I had done for all these bands. And I'm like, you're that guy. And he was like, you're that guy. And so we just became buddies, and we absolutely love Halloween and horror. And for some reason, I never learned how to read music or the notes or just anything, but I learned how to play lots and lots of songs. And since I was just, you know, solo, I would space out and play. And then I realized that I can play all these songs without looking at the guitar or the strings or anything. So I started doing monster drawing when I taught at Mass College of Art. I taught there for 13 years. And instead of having a regular life drawing model, I would come in, like kind of unannounced sometimes, in a monster suit with a big coffin case and just plunk it down like, you know, this is totally normal. And just play for 2 hours as a life drawing model. And it was super fun and ridiculous. And then with COVID, you're supposed to have live models in your class, but the class is remote. And I was like, I can't really book a model. And like the whole thing about like nudity and like being on the internet and all the stuff, I was like, I'll just do monster drawing and I won't tell students. You know, I'll just be like, hey, we have a model today. They don't speak English. And they're really volatile, but if you are professional, hopefully it'll go well. And then I'd be like the creature from the Black Lagoon and like play, you know, Slayer or whatever. And Riverwalk Brewing, they're right down the road and super nice guys. And they're like, do you want to do one of those here? And I was like, yes. Could Dan Blaisley come and do Dr. Gasp too? And they're like, even better. Like, just, so it was cold. I feel like I finally started to feel my fingers at the end of my set. Like, you get like a big monster head on and a big amp and it's like all boomy and you're like, I hope I'm doing this right. I hope I'm hitting all the right notes because I can't tell what's happened. I can't see my hands. And it was super fun. He's the best.
For real. He embodies the entire Halloween spirit more than just about everybody I've ever met. Because I went to see one of his performances in Portsmouth, New Hampshire in October because they were doing the outdoor one at the A3 venue. I think that's the name of it. And it was just amazing to get right into that Halloween vibe right at the end of October. And he just did such a good job bringing that forward. And I think it was that night afterward that it was posted, you guys were playing together. I'm like, shit, I should have gone to that one or at least done both. But it was, hopefully you guys collaborate again this October. And hopefully it doesn't necessarily have to be outside, but if it does, I will be there to watch the Monster Mash performance of the century.
Thank you. That would be awesome. I hope you were able to go. It was tough because the very night of the performance, like an hour before the performance, they had some massive plumbing issue in the brewery where like pipes burst and all these plumbers were like trying to fix it. And they were like, we have to close. And like people had already like bought tickets to Eventbrite and all the stuff. And he was like, what if we just have it outside and close the whole brewery? And it's just outside for the people who bought the tickets. And so there was like a smaller, but very Intuit crowd. I feel like if you just go to an outdoor concert, even if you don't have a ticket, you're going to hear it and experience it. So it was a much smaller crowd, and hopefully this year we can do it again and it'll be bigger and, you know, things will work out like plumbing wise.
Hopefully. Now, in addition to the comic that you're working on, are there any other current projects on your plate to work on?
It sounds crazy, especially during COVID when so many of my clients have like gone under, like permanently or temporarily. But I have been saying no to a lot of stuff because especially with my eyesight being horrible, I'm like, I just want to get Home for Little Conjurers, like a huge chunk of it done and in print and out there. I feel like life is short. You never know what's going to happen. And I've been really focused on that. Like every day I just roll out of bed and have some coffee and just like draw, post on Patreon and just, I want it done.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad that that's getting a large chunk of your focus. It's definitely something that I'm excited to see come to fruition and looking forward to having that on my graphic novel shelf where it belongs in its seat of glory. So that'll be very exciting to have that there.
Thank you. That's nice to hear.
Yeah, of course. Well, we have been going for a little bit, so we will start to wrap it up. I know we've already touched on where people can follow you online, but just to reiterate, where can people follow you and your art online?
It's MrRouche.com, and a lot of the artwork on that site, if you click on it, it'll bring you right to my Etsy shop, which is also like Etsy.com/MrRouche. The Patreon is Patreon.com/MrRouche. And I have, Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, and I try and post art regularly so that people can see how things are coming along.
Awesome. Well, definitely go check the page out. It's one of my absolute favorite ones that are online. You'll find all sorts of movies you haven't heard of through his art, all sorts of bands you haven't heard of yet through his art, and I promise you it's all worth it to check out. So definitely go give it a follow.
Thanks a million. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for doing the show, man. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to do it.
Sure. Thank you for asking. It was a great show.
Thank you.
I love all the other ones I've listened to, Michelle and Paul Tremblay, and Paul Tremblay's in Home for Little Conjurers. I just want to throw
him
in.
Oh, he is?
Yeah, I met him, and we're both Jaws and The Thing fans and Helmet and all this. I feel like we have all these shared interests. And I was like, there's a police officer in my story who becomes mega haunted. Would it be kind of okay if he's named Officer Tremblay? And he's like, oh, totally. Like, so.
Oh, he's in the I'm reaching over because I have it next to me. He was at the tail end of the one that's in the physical one, right?
Yeah, the physical.
Yeah, it says Tremblay right there. Oh my God, yeah. How did I not notice that?
the officer is kind of based a little bit on Matt Pike from Sleep and High on Fire, but I wanted the guy to be named Officer Tremblay. He's into it. So I'm like, yeah,
that's awesome. Sweet. Well, thanks, man. We have so much to look forward to from that comic coming out, and I hope you have a good rest of your day.
Great. Thanks. You too.
Thank you.
Thank you all so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. Please go check out Mark's Etsy page. There's a lot of good, incredible prints on there that belong on your walls. You could even use one of those to hide that tunnel you've been digging to escape. Don't worry, your secret is safe with me. If you're enjoying the show, please go give it a follow on social media. I'm at SlashningsPod on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. You can email me directly at SlashningsPod@gmail.com. And if you'd be ever so kind as to follow the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts as well, I'd really, really appreciate it. Well, that's all for me here this week. I'll be back in two more. Until then, keep it creepy.